If I had to name one fact about myself that probably surprises the most amount of people, it would be this. I am a huge fan of country music. I know. I'm not the typical representative of the country music target demographic. It's not the genre that most people expect a brown, classically trained vocalist from the great state of New York, of all places, who is an unapologetic feminist with a political framework that falls, let's just say, on the left end of the spectrum, to be blasting in the car on a long road trip, or to use to pump himself up in the gym. And yeah, I know that the Nashville music industry has its fair share of problems rooted in misogyny and racism, but then again, so does a lot of the popular music industry. Truth be told, I'm not entirely sure what it is about country music that keeps my radio dial tuned to 98.7 WMZQ, DC's one-stop shop for today's best country. If anyone out here is from iHeartRadio, I accept sponsorships. When I was a kid, I actually hated the genre, but that didn't stop my own father from listening to the likes of Shania Twain and Alan Jackson while my brother and I were stuck in the car with him. But as I got older, there was something about the simplicity of the genre that drew me back in. And yes, I know a lot of that is probably about as manufactured and authentic as the tchotchkes you find in a Cracker Barrel country store right off the interstate, but at their best, country music tells stories. Stories about love and loss, life and death, joy and hardships. And the music lets these stories shine through, you know, three chords and the truth and all that. And sure, I get that country music has a reputation of sometimes being overly dramatic and melancholy, but let's be honest. If your wife leaves you, your dog dies, and your truck breaks down, you're not having the best of days, are you? At its best, country music is deeply relatable. Consider, if you will, Miranda Lambert's hit 2013 single, Mama's Broken Heart. It's a song about a girl who is having a rough time going through a breakup. And so her mom, who comes from, as the narrator puts it, a softer generation, comes along and tells her to go and fix your makeup, girl. It's just a breakup, girl. Start acting like a lady. I raised you better. Gotta keep it together, even when things fall apart. To which the narrator defiantly cries out, yeah, but this ain't my mama's broken heart. Now I need you all to hold on to your seats real quick, because this might shock you. But not once in my life have I ever been a young girl going through a traumatic breakup. I know, I'm as surprised as you are. And yet I still really relate to this song. Throughout my own life, I felt all sorts of implied and explicit pressures to keep my emotions in check, to get a grip and bite my lip just to save a little face, to never let them see you cry. These pressures have come from external forces like media and culture in general, and intimate places like from my family and friends and the people who I love. So I've never felt the urge to cut my bangs with some rusty kitchen scissors, like the girl in the song, but I have felt the need to suppress the feelings that I was feeling. And so I find something really cathartic about the narrator's clapback to the one telling her to stuff it all in. I suspect that I'm not the only one in here who feels pressure to suppress their emotions from time to time, to build up a thick facade and present a picture of your life to the world that is perfect, all while stifling any emotional expression that might reveal the cracks. Because if the world knew the truth, the honest truth, about how we were feeling, that perfect picture we spent so long and worked so hard at cultivating would fall apart, and the wall would come tumbling down. And we'd be left in a state of profound vulnerability that, in spite of our instinct to share everything in our networked and digital age, is a posture we just aren't accustomed to in today's day and age. A state of profound vulnerability with which we haven't been comfortable with for a really long time. We can thank Stoicism for that. You see, in the Greco-Roman world, in which everything about life and society and culture were highly ordered, the goal of life was to be as virtuous, to be as manly as possible. Influenced by the Stoic philosophers of their time, who believed that the virtuous life was a life governed by reason and dispassionate rational thinking, being as manly as possible meant not letting emotional responses dictate the way you lived your life. This kind of virtuous life is one which everyone, regardless of their station, regardless of their gender, was to strive for. Having an emotional outburst of any sort made you more womanly, which was to be avoided at all costs. The hold of the patriarchy goes way back. A couple thousand years and one boost from an enlightenment later, and this gendered line of thinking still persists. When we tell our boys to man up, or that men don't cry, usually at the sight of a quivering lip or as their eyes are starting to well up with tears, we are reinforcing this dangerous ideology that to show your emotions or express your feelings is womanly, and to appear womanly robs you of your worth as a human. And how many times have women been told in the response to emotional distress, abuse, harassment, or trauma, that if they want to survive in a man's world, they'll just have to suck it up? It's the same dangerous underlying philosophy, just remixed for a different gender. Of course, when we put it in terms like that and name it like that, it sounds absurd to us. I'm sure that there's no one in here who consciously thinks that womanly expressions make a person inherently less worthy. And if there are any people who do think that in here, I would like to kindly direct their attention to our two United Methodist women groups who are in all of their womanly glory doing amazing, amazing work in the Falls Church community and beyond to keep our church's mission and vision alive and well. Nevertheless, even though we recognize that the underlying reason behind our discomfort when it comes to expressing our emotions is sexist and dangerous, the fact remains that we still have difficulty giving those who we interact with, even those with whom we are most close, our family, our friends, our loved ones, an honest and authentic picture of our emotional state of minds. Who among us, when asked, "How are you doing?" has never responded with, "Fine," when we knew deep down that things were not fine, that the world was not fine, that we were not fine. And I'll be the first to admit that the church is not blameless when it comes to this. I grew up in a church that was very, let's just say, prim and proper. Everything had to be perfect. Our choirs had to be the best choirs. Our preachers had to be the best, most qualified preachers. Our sanctuary had to be the prettiest, most beautifully ornate sanctuary. And don't get me wrong, I really did love it. I loved listening to our world-renowned organist in residence wail away at magnificent preludes and postludes, and I wouldn't trade the crash course on theological discourse that my young mind tried to absorb in the form of dense sermons for anything in the world. Both experiences laid the foundation for my love of music and theology that I carry with me to this very day. But as I look back on those formative years, I have to confess that I rarely, if ever, receive the message that it's okay to not be okay. How many times, when we have gathered for worship throughout our lives, have we received that message? How often does it appear in our hymns, in our prayers, in our fellowship together? My guess is that for many of us, the answer would be not enough. And that's a real shame. Because when we look at our scriptural witness, we see a profoundly different picture. Our lesson from the Psalms this morning is just one example among many. The psalm uses imagery of a vineyard destroyed, not unlike the lesson from Isaiah. However, in the psalm, the destruction of the vineyard is not seen as an act of God's righteous divine judgment, like it is in Isaiah, but rather it carries the perception that God failed to be faithful to the covenant. You brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with its shade, the mighty cedars with its branches. It sent out branches to the sea and its shoots to the river. Why then have you broken down its walls so that all who pass along the way pluck at its fruit? Why then have you broken down its walls? Why then have you broken down its walls? This isn't a prayer of confession. The psalmist doesn't say that they did anything wrong, nor are they pleading for forgiveness. It's not the result of an act of repentance either. The psalmist even makes a point of later saying, "Then we will never turn back from you." Then we will never turn back from you. Not, "We know that we have turned away from you and have seen the error of our ways and have reoriented our lives back to you." No, it's, "Let your hand be upon us again, and then we will never turn our back from you." This prayer is something else entirely. It's called a lament. And guess what? The Psalms are chock full of them. As many as one third of the Psalms are Psalms of lament. It's why 16th century Swiss reformer John Calvin called them an anatomy of all parts of the soul, since they represent all the emotions we could ever know we have, like a mirror. Or as a chaplain of mine was fond of saying, "Your wife left, your dog died, and your truck broke down? There's a psalm for that." These psalms of lament encourage us to look at the fire raging all around us and say, "This isn't fine. Things are not fine. The world is not fine. We are not fine." And what's more, these psalms also encourage us to adopt that same posture in our relationship with God. The book of Psalms is our common scriptural prayer book, after all. Each of the 150 psalms teach us how to pray in ways that are authentic to our lived experiences and faithful to God. And the psalms of lament hold a special place in that scriptural liturgy. Denise Domkowski-Hopkins, author of Journey Through the Psalms, and my Hebrew Bible professor while I was at seminary, identifies the Psalms of Lament as being the most faithful prayers a believer can pray. It's really easy to pray a prayer of thanksgiving when things are going well, she says, but to be in a place of deep despair and to cry out, "Show yourself, come and save us," shows that you, one, still acknowledge that God exists and cares about your cries, and two, believe that God has the capacity to do something about them, to relieve them. Laments come from a place of hope, deep hope, hope in a world that is more perfect than the world we find ourselves in, hope that a more perfect world is possible. I remember a couple years ago, I went through romantic heartbreak myself while I was in seminary. And to make matters worse, the heartbreak carried with it a real shake to my sense of call. More than the lost relationship, I desperately wanted that strong sense of call back. And so I tried praying like I was typically taught, you know, hands folded, head down. I tried reaching out to friends and pastors for support. But in the end, what brought me the most peace was sneaking into the chapel late one night after class. It was dark, and I was the only one there. And I just let God have it. If you remember that one scene from The West Wing where Jed Bartlett is in the National Cathedral after his secretary and longtime friend's funeral, it was kind of like that, only louder and with less Latin. I screamed at God. I cussed God out using just about every word in the book. I questioned what more God wanted from me. And when I ran out of words and my voice gave out, I collapsed onto the floor, and I wept like I hadn't wept in a long time. And as the walls of that sacred space echoed with the sounds of my cries and my profanities, I felt a calming presence wash over me. That night, I had the best night's sleep I had since the breakup. God doesn't want us to stifle our emotions in the ways we interact with and relate to anyone. God doesn't tell us to fix our makeup. God doesn't tell us to just get over it, to keep it together, even when we fall apart. Each and every one of our emotions is a God-given gift that we are meant to honestly and faithfully express in our lives and in our relationships, especially our relationship with God. Because guess what? God already knows the full extent of our emotional well-being. See, when we lament, we honor our realities, our actual messy realities, not the pristine and perfect ones we try to convince the world and ourselves is real, but our actual lived truths. And naming that things aren't fine is the first step we need to take on the road to making a world that is. Amen.